Sunday school lesson for June 21st, 1959.
This morning our lesson is on Jehoshaphat, the wise king of Judah. And we go over to the second Chronicles, two or three chapters in Second Chronicles. You know, Jehoshaphat was the fourth king of Judah after the breakup of the northern and the southern kingdoms. You have to go over to Chronicles to get the story, because in Kings, the book of Kings, they give more emphasis to the northern kingdom. Although they speak of the events in the southern kingdom, they seem to emphasize the northern kingdom. And over in Second Chronicles, they give you more of the story of the southern kingdom. Now, as I said, he was the fourth king of Judah. He came to the throne about 914 A.D. when he was 35 years old, and he reigned 25 years, the son of Asa. You remember Asa had, his father had fortified cities around the border of the country and had built up some national defense, as we call it. And when Jehoshaphat came to the throne following the death of his father, he placed forces in all the fenced cities of Judah. And the third year of his reign, he sent to the princes, even to Ben-Hail and others, to teach in the cities of Judah. He sent teachers out to the country towns. He established a system of education, so to speak. And I think it's one of the significant things. When he established this system of education, and with them, he sent Levites to teach the religion as well as the other learning of the land. He had the book of the law of the Lord with them. And he became famous by reason of his system of education, by reason of the national defenses that he built up, and the Philistines and the Arabians sent him tributes of silver and flocks. In other words, they paid tribute to him. And he had riches and honor and abundance, and joined affinity with Ahab. Now, what happened there was, Ahab was still ruling in the north. Remember the story of Ahab and Jezebel. And in order to establish better relations with the north, because there had been a feud between the north and the south up to this time, Jehoshaphat thought it was well to start to establish better relations with his neighbors. And he went up to Samaria and made an alliance, we might say, with Ahab. And he brought about a marriage of his oldest son, Jehoram, with Ahab's daughter, Athaliah. That, to me, is a very interesting circumstance here, that he would go up and have his oldest son marry the daughter of Ahab, Jehoram. And you remember after that marriage, if you look ahead just a little bit, Jehoram died. Athaliah wanted to take over the throne south for herself, the evil woman that she was. One of the worst women, I suppose, in the whole Bible. And she caused all of her children and grandchildren to be put to death so that they couldn't claim the throne from her. But there was one little grandchild who was hid away by his nurse, Joash. And later on, Joash came to the throne. Well, that was talked about in here as a pretty bad alliance, that he should never have gone up and made an alliance with Ahab. When he went up to Ahab, Ahab put up the proposition to him that he was going into battle. And he asked Jehoshaphat if he would join with him. And in a moment of weakness, he agreed to do it. And they went into battle against the advice of the Ramoth-Gilead, against the advice of the prophet. And when they got into battle, Ahab, in his shrewd way, said to Jehoshaphat, "I'm going to disguise myself because I know they'll be trying to get me." And Jehoshaphat somewhere agreed to that. Well, they went into battle. He said to Jehoshaphat, says, "But put thou on thy robe." In other words, he made Jehoshaphat very apparent that he hid himself, don't you see? and they went into battle. But some of the evil forces recognized him, and Ahab was there slain in battle. And Jehoshaphat was injured but managed to get away. Well, that brings us down to the 19th chapter. And Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned to his house in peace to Jerusalem. And Jehu, the son of Hanan, the seer, went out to meet him and said to the king Jehoshaphat, "Shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord? Therefore is wrath upon thee from before the Lord. Nevertheless, there are good things found in thee, in that thou hast taken away the groves out of the land and hast prepared thine heart to seek God." And Jehoshaphat dwelt in Jerusalem. And he went out again through the people from Beersheba even to Mount Ephraim and brought them back into the Lord God of his fathers. And he set judges in the land throughout the fenced cities of Judah, city by city, and said to the judges, "Take heed that you do what you do, for you judge not for man, but for the Lord, who is with you in the judges. Wherefore now let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Take heed and do it, for there is no iniquity with the Lord our God, nor respect of persons, nor taking of gifts." Moreover, in Jerusalem did Jehoshaphat set the Levites, and of the priests, and of the chief of the fathers of Israel, for the judgment of the Lord, and for controversies when they returned to Jerusalem. And he charged them, saying, "Thus shall you do in the fear of the Lord, faithfully and with a perfect heart. And what cause soever shall come to you of your brother that dwelled in the city, between blood and blood, between law and commandment, statutes and judgments, you shall even warn them that they trespass not against the Lord, and so wrath come upon you and upon your brother. This do, and ye shall not trespass. And behold, Amariah, the chief priest, is over you, and in all matters of the Lord. And Zebediah, the son of Ishmael, the ruler of the house of Judah, for all the king's matters. Also the Levites shall be officers before you. Deal courageously, and the Lord shall be with the good." In other words, he said to them, "I'm going to create all this system of courts throughout the land." And he reformed the whole judicial system, and the appeals were taken to Jerusalem. But when they came to Jerusalem, the Levites, the priestly class, judged in spiritual matters, but he had temporal judges to judge in matters, he says, affecting the king. In temporal matters. This is the only case in the whole history of Judah where one good king followed another, Asa and his son Jehoshaphat. There were about five good kings in the southern kingdom. There was Jehoshaphat, Asa his father, Hezekiah, and Josiah. Well, as I said, his father had left him a well-trained army and had left him a very good reputation, so he started out well. The first thing he did was to outlaw the groves, that is, the worship of heathen kings, and he established this system of education. He strengthened the defenses, and he overhauled the legal system, and he built a navy. He had it stationed down here, way down here in the wilderness at Ethian Beaver. That's what they're quarreling about over there now, yet today, about that their right to use the waterways in that very place. You see, David and Solomon had spent much of their time in deciding private controversies. Here comes a man who learns how to delegate authority, and he creates this system of judges. And he got the admiration not only of his own people, but also of the foreign nation. He was famed because of his reliance upon God, because of the respect which he deserved, and because of this great revival that he started out. But of course, there is danger in prosperity, and when he became very rich and prosperous, he made this alliance with Ahab, which is very much criticized. For which he was very much criticized. And I think one of the first points of this lesson is that there is a responsibility to God in the administration of justice. We don't just make rules. Of course, in our complex society, many of the laws we had price controls and all that sort of thing, many detailed laws. But fundamentally, the laws that we enforce are not just man-made laws. They're sort of declaratory, you might say, of what's right and wrong. Our laws are based on right and wrong. We try to get to what is right and what is wrong. Throughout the whole Old Testament, the Jewish people at this time had not made any distinction between religious and civil law. The whole Bible contains the Old Testament, contains pure food laws. It's all run in together. They didn't make a distinction. The lawyers and the preachers were not different from each other. But here, for the first time, he makes a distinction between the priestly class, who are determined religious questions, and the secular class, who were determined secular questions. Even back in Deuteronomy, he said, not for man, but for the Lord. And so this man is saying to the judges, when you go to judge people, remember, you're standing there, so to speak, as an agent of the Lord. You're judging people under the laws, which are fundamentally the laws of the Lord. This man was a remarkable combination of a civil and a religious leader, Jehoshaphat. You see, the Mosaic concept of law was that it was rooted in God, not in man. Justice is a divine thing. And we used to talk about, law school used to talk about such things as natural laws, and then in a way they made light of it. But there was such a thing as natural law. Made light of them because we were studying about laws and how to go about and have courts to enforce laws. But there is such a thing. Back of it all is what is fundamentally right and wrong, and on that our law is based. And I think that is the basis. When Christ said, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. That is the whole spirit. It's based on right and wrong. And the judging is a prerogative of God, delegated to men. You know, many lawyers, I think, have deserved the rebuke that Luke gave them when he said, woe unto you lawyers, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. Ye enter not yourselves, and them that were entering in ye hinder. That's what Luke says over there in one place about lawyers. It says, but I think instead of that, there is a responsibility, a sense of responsibility, a responsibility to God in the administration of law. I quote from Clyde Francisco in one of the helps that I read this remarkable statement. I think it states it much better than I can. All valid human law is but the imperfect reflection of the divine scheme on the order of for the order of the universe. That's a remarkable statement of it, isn't it? All valid human law is but the imperfect reflection of the divine scheme for the order of the universe. Of course, we know we still have Judge Lynch, and we still have Judge Fleece, and so on, in our administration of law. I'm happy to say that in my experience, I have found them to be very exceptional. But you know, somebody said the Constitution is what the court says it is. The laws are what the court say they are. I heard one of the commencement speeches along the last few weeks. Somebody said, well, there were three baseball umpires that got together. And one of these umpires said, well, I call them as a season. And the second one says, I call them as they are. And the third says, well, ain't nothing until I call. There's a lot of truth in that illustration. The law is what the court decides it is, so to speak. If you don't have righteous judges, you don't have administration of the law. And so I say the first point I get on this is responsibility to God in the administration of our legal system. And the second point I get out of this lesson is that there's religion and democracy go hand in hand. sometimes we question. Somehow man cannot sin alone. We still are trying to prove that proposition which Lincoln referred to. We're trying in this great experiment, that's still an experiment in this country, to prove the government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. And it's being challenged. And certainly half of the people of the world are saying it won't work. And you haven't proved it, and it won't last. Plenty of people say it. And it's true, it will not last. Unless everybody in a democracy feels their responsibility and helps to make it. That's in religion and in government both. If we don't have the public supporting the system, we'll no longer have the system. Man cannot sin alone. Man goes out here and he drives recklessly, the danger is that somebody else will be hurt. And so on, you could multiply the illustration. Whatever you do that's wrong, you do wrong to others as well as to yourself. Now when you take the other side of the picture, you take our continual argument with Russia. They say, well, they have the great system. And I must say, in some ways, it seems to work. We have a lot of trouble sometimes meeting their challenges that they make to us. They're more efficient than we are when it comes to preparing for war. They do a lot of things. They claim that they're overcoming illiteracy better than we are. They're building a great industrial system. They're doing lots of things. But freedom is a very expensive thing. We give up a whole lot for free, but it's a very valuable thing, and all the peoples of the world long for free. You know, the weakness of Russia may take a long time to prove it, but I'm reading an old book here this week, Seven Great Statesmen by White. He used to be president of Cornell University, and it's a great book. This particular copy I got, I was just rotten at the pages, almost break when I turned them. But I read this. He was talking, of course, he wrote this book back before the time of the Russians, back about 1910, I think. But he made this statement, and I think you can reflect on it. How a great dictator has no assurance of the right kind of succession. He says Frederick the Great was followed by Frederick William the Fat, Charlemagne by Charles the Simple, Charles the Fifth by Philip the Second, Elizabeth by a line of Stuart, Henry the Fourth by Louis the XIII from France, Napoleon the First by Napoleon the Third, Joseph the Second by Francis the First, Peter the Great by Alexis, Catherine by a Paul, Nicholas the First by Nicholas the Second. So it is. That's one of the great weaknesses. Dictators seem to thrive, but in the end, the great danger that sometime or other, we've witnessed it just in the last few years, when Stalin died. It was a contest about who would be the successor. And Khrushchev finally eliminated his competitor by sending him off to Russia and elsewhere. He eliminated. There was a controversy at the top. But at no time since the beginning of communism in Russia have the people ever had a voice in expressing themselves as to what kind of a government they wanted. They didn't have any voice just then. Nothing. That's one of the weaknesses of the Russian success system. Well, unless we all participate in the church and in the state, we cannot have that kind of democracy. That's one of the weaknesses, I think, of it. I don't want to talk against the Catholic Church, but I think it's one of the weaknesses of the Catholic Church is that the priests are the ones who have the access to God. And I think it's one of those things that they gradually will come out of. But I think that that is one of the weaknesses. All must participate in any kind of democratic government. Wisdom cometh from above. You know, in the National Presbyterian Church over there in Washington, they've got a pew that was occupied by Lincoln. It's occupied, I believe, now by Eisenhower. It's been a pew they call the President's Pew. I think it's a wonderful thing that a church can have a place for the President. Recognized by the place they go to in the church. Well, there's a recent book out by Status Seekers. Have you seen the new book, Status Seekers? And he goes on to show that somewhere or other, democracy is more than more of an ideal than a reality. People strive for position, social, other kind of position. We have a Christian conscience, somebody has said, but our social and economic activities are given to material things. Just to thinking in Russia, it's illegal to do what we're doing right here now. You can't have a Sunday school in Russia. They realize, over in Russia, that there is a connection between democracy and religion, and therefore they say for their system to prevail, they must get rid of religion. Else they might drift into a democracy. And then here over in this 19th chapter, wherefore let the Spirit of the Lord be upon you, take heed and do it, for there is no iniquity but the Lord our God. Take heed. The little boy in the class didn't seem to be paying attention, and the teacher said to him, "Johnny, do you have difficulty in hearing?" And he said, "Well, no, but I have great difficulty in listening." And I think that's our trouble. We have great difficulty in listening. Don't take heed of it. This thing of corrupt judgment. What was it John Marshall said? The greatest curse ever visited by an angry God on a sinning people is a corrupt judiciary. The greatest curse. Way out in the early days in Nevada, there's some judge trying a case. He got up on the bench and said, "Gentlemen, the plaintiff has sent to the judge of this court $10,000. And the defendant has sent to the court $15,000. And the court's going to return $5,000 to the defendant, and we're going to try this case on the merits." Well, there is a connection. There is a connection between religion and democracy. Let's not lose faith in democracy, though sometimes it seems to be put to a very severe test. And then the third thing that I got out of this lesson, perhaps on account of an experience I had recently, is that there's so much that we do not know. I don't have much difficulty in people coming to me and say, "How do you answer this in the Bible?" And I say, "Well, there's a whole lot of things in there I just don't know the answer to. They're not so many that trouble me, but if you're troubled by things, there's a small group that meets in this town, a very fine group of men, that I dropped in on last Sunday or Sunday before last. And they asked me some questions. Very intelligent, very well-read men. And they asked me some questions. What about the Old Testament? How can you accept the fact that God said to the devil, 'You take Job and put him to the test'? How can you justify in the Old Testament that God helped the Israelite nation to go out and punish and mistreat their neighbors? How do you justify those things?" "Well, there's so many things," they said, "and the Old Testament just seemed terrible." Well, I said, "The first place. In the first place, I would say there are also a great many wonderful things in the Old Testament. You take the prophets and the Psalms and that very book of Job, which is a dramatic, philosophical book. And you take some of those things. There's many wonderful things, in addition to the things that you point out, which are historically perhaps a little difficult to explain. And I don't know that I can give you the answer. But I think a second thing you ought to realize is this. That is the literature of a primitive people. Our ancestors weren't writing any literature at this time. We go back 1,000 years before Christ. And it may be that their understanding of religion hadn't developed to the place. There is such a thing as an evolution. Not of religion, but an evolution of our ability to understand their religion. I think Christ recognized that when he said, 'I came not to destroy the law, but to fulfill it.' He was going to fulfill, he wasn't changing the law. He was fulfilling our understanding of the law. He realized people by that time had come to the place where they could understand a little higher aspect of the law. And so it is. I think that there are many things you can say about that, but I don't think you could come in and say you can answer all the questions. Now, Einstein said, There is so much in science that we do not know, that we do not understand. I think the same thing's true of religion, and I think it means that we've got to continually study our religion, and we learn more. In the excavations they make over there, we learn more from such a thing as these records they found over in the caves, the old Dead Sea Scrolls, they call them. We're learning more all the time, but we need to study our religion. We need this educational system that this man Jehoshaphat started out throughout the land. We need to learn more. We need to study constantly. Over in Washington in the archives building, there's a big sign out in front. It says, "What is past is prologue." And if somebody riding around in a taxi cab, and you know how those taxi cab drivers talk in Washington, they talk over here. And he said, "What does that mean? All that is past is prologue." And this taxi cab driver said, "Well, it means you ain't seen nothing yet." And I think maybe it's something. You ain't seen nothing yet. There's a whole lot we have yet to learn. Now, one of the problems, speaking of those problems, one of the problems, and one of the reasons I say this lesson raised it in my mind, is God was very critical of Ahab for making this alliance, trying to make peace with Ahab. It had the feud before, up to his time. The north and the south despised each other. They wouldn't have talked to anybody from the Arabia. But here he goes up and he has his son marry the daughter of Ahab. And then he's very much criticized for it. And one of the comments I read in one of these commentaries of the Bible said it was an ecclesiastical bigotry to say that he couldn't go up and make a compact and try to make peace with his neighbor. Well, we run into that today. Should we recognize communist China? Did we make a mistake in recognizing Russia? Is the Catholic Church right in refusing to let its members come into another kind of a congregation? Well, what about that? How are you going to answer that question? Was it wrong for him to go up and make the alliance that they had? And then if you look back, didn't the Lord himself condemn that? Didn't he go up through Arabia himself and stop and talk to the woman at the well in Arabia? And a simple woman at that, much to her surprise, because the old feud between Arabia and Judah still existed at his time. And I don't know the answer to it. It's one of those things, again, that I have to say I do not know. I believe it's well to try to make peace with your neighbors, but for some reason at this time, the Lord thought he shouldn't have done that, and he certainly shouldn't have gone as far as he did. He should never have joined in battle with Ahab. And as it turned out, he certainly shouldn't have let his son, Jehoram, marry the wicked Athaliah. And also, pure sideline, I mentioned this, I suspect, several times because it's one of the favorite things. When you trace through these kings of southern Judah, it's the line of David, coming from David right on down, through Jehoshaphat, Asa, Jehoshaphat, and his son Jehoram, and so on, right down to Joseph. In the first chapter of Genesis. And Jehoram, they call it Joram in there, it's abbreviated, but it's Joram, is this very Jehoram. And so this marriage was a very important thing, tracing the line of David. Athaliah was an ancestor of Joseph, the husband of Mary. And her mother was Ahab was, and his wife Jezebel was also. Well, at any rate, he's criticized here, but they said, "But you have other good qualities, so it's not fit," what they said about it. Of course, you can't compromise with God. And that we must recognize. Over the time of the Civil War, there's some fellow tried to play safe and said he's going to get him a blue coat and gray trousers, and see if that would take you in both sides shot at him. That's the difficulty when you try to compromise the president. Well, we learn all the time. We're constantly learning something. This man at one of these commencement speeches I heard at the president of the University of Michigan, he said, "Why, we used to think, and it's certainly true, that all that goes up comes down. We found that isn't true anymore. We send things up, don't ever come down. They go on up to stay up. So it isn't true. We're learning something we thought was very fundamental." is no longer true. All goes up, comes down. And then there's this place of mercy. And I think it's a great argument for mercy. And the judges always get a more or less imperfect picture of what happens. You know, in a trial, you're relying on the testimony of witnesses. Well, witnesses relying on their five senses don't always see the whole story. They see, if you have several witnesses, you know they tell a different story. They see a different part of the accident or whatever it is. And then the record's made up, and then the judges decide on the record. And the record may not be, may or may not be, absolute true picture. It may be a very faulty picture of what happened. And so it's a great argument for a little mercy. Sergeant Prentice one time closed the plea to a jury in an argument that he made with these words. He said, I've somewhere read that when God and his eternal counsels conceived the thought of man's creation, he called to him three ministers to wait constantly upon the throne, justice, truth, and mercy. And he thus addressed them, shall we make man? And justice said, O God, make him not, for he would trample upon thy laws. And truth said, O God, make him not, for he will pollute thy sanctuary. And mercy exclaimed, O God, make him. I will watch over him through all the dark pain he paths he may have to tread. And then God made man and said to him, thou art the child of mercy. Go in mercy and deal with thy brother. You know, Dulles was a very religious man. He made this statement. He said, the Bible means to me that there is a God, and he has purposes for men, and that each of us has the task to find and immerse him in the stream of the divine purpose. And when I was talking to these men that put those questions to me about the Old Testament, I couldn't give you one answer I made to them, kind of reaching out, trying to think how to answer people that ask questions like that. I said this, you study the Bible. You may have some questions that you have now about the Old Testament. Maybe you'll find some in the New Testament. I venture to say, when you come down to the teachings of Christ and the life of Christ, you won't have any questions there. You may say the standard he set was higher than you're going to think. You won't have those questions as long as you study the teachings of Christ. All of the rest led up to that. And you know, the story is told about Italian Papini that wrote the life of Christ. Very intelligent man. And he started out writing that book in order to show that the Bible was not true. And he had to do a lot of study in preparing the book. And as writing the book, and he comes to study the teachings of Christ, and he became a converted man. He couldn't deny the reality when he got right down to making a study of the thing. So we have text. Take heed what you do, for you judge not for man, but for the Lord, which is with you in the judgment. I read this little verse the other day. Look away from the things that perish. Wood and stone will soon decay. Fix your eyes on things eternal. God in heaven will stand for aid. He is able, he is willing. He will guide you all the way. Take your eyes off things that perish. Look to him. Trust and pray.
Thank you, Mr. Wolford.